You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
This episode is being recorded in front of a live studio audience. Can you hear it? I'm not kidding. Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Captain Dean, and I'm coming to you from Spencer's Coffee House, beautiful downtown Bowling Green. And today, my guest is none other, the one, the only, Colonel Ian Harper. How are you doing, Ian?
I am doing great. Thank you for having me here, Captain.
It is good to have you here, and let's get started. Are you from Bowling Green?
Well, believe it or not, I'm going to try to cut my over-the-top radio interview voice. Well, fancy you should say that. you told me to act natural, and I do these interviews
lying.
Too, and I for some reason, I can't. I have to play a character at all times, but... I am somewhat from the Bowling Green area. Through my entire music career, I have lived in Bowling Green, but originally I am from Lockport, New York, which is why I have a Yankee accent when I sing that I don't like.
Can you get rid of that?
I don't know. I've tried really hard, man.
I've noticed British singers can sound American pretty good. So
that's true. And American
can
singers
sound
can sound British. I don't even like Greta Van Fleet that much, but I listen to them and I'm like, why are they singing with British slang?
I mean, apart from
trying really hard to be Led Zeppelin.
It's the mystery of music, I guess. So you are from upstate New York.
I'm from upstate New York.
Practically Canadian, eh?
Pretty much. I like to describe Lockport, New York. It's just outside of Buffalo, New York. It's like... Imagine there was a part of Canada that Canada was like, oh, can we get rid of that? Can we just like, hey, it's a gift. We don't want. And so we ended up in the United States.
It's no man's land.
Thank you to any of my relatives from upstate New York listening.
So upstate New York ended up in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, that was mostly my dad for work. We had to move whenever I was younger. Slash, I think they kind of looked around and saw that there wasn't going to be many opportunities in the area. I love Buffalo, and a lot of people still think of Buffalo as a major city, but Buffalo is in the same kind of situation economically as, say, like Detroit, and that jobs are all moving. You know, it's really not worth trying to start a living there if you're not originally from the area. So we moved to Bowling Green, to a much smaller city, and oddly enough, moving from the Lockport, Buffalo area to here, I think, gave me music opportunities I wouldn't have had otherwise. I don't know if I ever would have been able to pursue music professionally, if you want to call this professionally.
Sure.
Where does it become professional?
Where's the line drawn? I think it depends on your level of talent.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah, because if you're able to play a G chord but very crappy, then you're intermediate beginner, and if you can play a G chord and make it sound like, you know, the heavens have opened up, then you're professional.
Well, I like to think of us as professionals, but I think you and I are just a couple of goofballs that happen to have instruments with
us. We're decent.
Yeah. No, we're talented, but we're still that
not
whole
classically
professional.
Trained.
No.
So,
nah.
Okay, Your dad obviously moves down here for work. What age were you when you ended up here?
I was 6 years old.
Oh, so you really don't know much about the New York state of mind. You were born there, but you transplanted pretty quick.
Yeah, every time we go back to Buffalo or Lockport, as much as I love family there, and as much as I love different landmarks and things, you know, the fun things that I did as a child up there, it feels less like home. And I never really felt like I was a Southerner, probably because I got picked on in school because of my Northern accent, which is crazy to me because I sure can't hear it anymore. I speak with...
Oh, don't you know?
I mean, I speak with descriptive grammar. I speak with, you know, the Southern dialect, and
yep.
I throw my y'alls and fixins.
I think that's just part of, what do you call it, adapting or... Your surroundings kind of wear off on you no matter what you are.
And I even tried to, like, I think everybody has a bit of a stage persona. You know, nobody's really the same person off stage as they are on.
I am. I'm not kidding.
Well, yeah. But at some point, you do kind of, like, throw on a bit of an act. Or whenever you, if you're not necessarily an extrovert on your own.
True.
You try to throw on something to, like,
it's
almost kind of lie to yourself.
It's putting on the mask and... All
yeah.
that stuff.
whenever I do that, I go full Southerner. My shoes are off when I play drums. When I sing, I'm like, I reckon y'all gonna have a good time tonight. We's fixing to do some blues.
Well, speaking of drumming,
yes,
that is how I first met you. You were a drummer, and I thought that's what you were. And it turns out I was wrong. You are very much in the same boat as me. You are very multi-instrumentalist in a way. You not only play guitar and piano, if I'm not mistaken. You're a talented singer and have an outstanding voice as well. What would you say is your main instrument?
My main instrument is definitely drums.
Okay.
And I really enjoy being a multi-instrumentalist, especially because it made songwriting so much easier for me.
Right.
I mean, it's really tough to explain to other bandmates, like, how... And, of course, by the time I was playing with other bands, I wasn't... I mean, I knew how to play other instruments a little bit, but... If you are a drummer and you do want to learn how to write music, pick up a guitar, sit down at a piano for a little bit.
It definitely helps.
Yeah.
Like, I think broaden the mindset of being in the world of your bandmates and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You if you know how to play guitar but you're a drummer full time, at least you get an idea of where the guitar player might be going with something. So it's like you can kind of foresee the way things might be laid out or something.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And to answer your question, I'm always going to be a drummer first, just because that's what I have the most fun doing.
Right.
I think it's the instrument that I'm best at. I don't know, man.
I heard you play guitar earlier today on some video you uploaded.
Yeah.
You're good.
I like to do streams.
It's good. And you played banjo.
Yeah, I did.
So you're a banjoist.
I'm, well, a little bit.
From New York.
I'm trying, man. That's always one of my... This is a weird thing, but without diving into anything too personal, with going through a band experience, whenever you try to record with either band members or sessions, musicians, at a certain point, if you're going to record something on your own, if there's something that you know you want in the song, it's easier to just do it yourself.
Right.
And I got to the point where I didn't like arguments that would start as a result of trying to write something for somebody or somebody not being able to do something that I was hoping to get them to do, or, you know, them just not liking the way that I write. But at the same time, you know, what they would add wouldn't really work with the song. And that's not to say that I don't like collaboration. I really like collaboration.
That's just part
but
of it. I mean, some people are better at it than others, and
There does become a point where you start acting too much like Brian Wilson. You're like, all right, I want you to do this, 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 and this in a song. And if
do
somebody,
exactly as I say, and then go on tour and make all the money for
yeah.
me.
And then if they don't learn it, or they don't contribute something, they don't bring anything to the table on their own, you're at the point where you're like, well, I'm just losing hair over, you know, nothing.
Right.
This isn't really worth the stress. And why not do it on my own? Or why not bring on, like, one or two other people if I know a specific track that I want, but for the rest of it, I can handle it.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what the beautiful thing about music is, the freedom, I think. And some people are very chokehold about things and ideas, and they don't want to share things. And some people are just completely wide open. Like, you know, let's work together. Let's find common ground and all that stuff. So I've known you for 3 years, maybe something like that. And
I think that sounds about
definitely
right.
Been always just super cool to hang out and talk to you about music. And I learned pretty early on that you're one of those, you know, that
yeah.
is open to the idea of working and collaborating and testing new waters. And there's no, you know, necessarily bad things there, you know, like to you, like, because some people just have that. They're afraid to try things and ask questions and do things, and you don't seem to be like that to me. So we've worked together, we've collaborated on a song or two, and I've had you in my studio, and you've had me play on a song that you wrote, and so that's my personal experience. But when I met you, you know, you were playing drums in a band called Mo Pie, which I think a lot of people may still recognize the name. You guys did quite good, but prior to Mo Pie, what did you do? What was your first band before you really got started in the, like, playing out and stuff?
My first band, I don't even know how to describe. I guess that doesn't count because we never really did anything much. A lot of the bands that I was in whenever I was younger was me and friends of mine who would play instruments, but without sounding arrogant or anything, I wouldn't say that I was... I don't want to put down anybody else's musicianship, but there was a certain point where
ahead.
I was very adamant whenever I was younger about I want to push myself to be good at this.
Well, I think I think you're the type that had the passion and the care, and you knew what you wanted and knew what you wanted it to be like. And it's hard to convey that to people that maybe don't care or just, you know, it's kind of more of a hobby. You can always tell when it's a hobby to somebody and not like a full-blown passionate artwork performer approach, you know. And
you
a
know,
true artist, like any other thing that involves art, usually is consumed with it. It's every day. It's all the time. And I've met a lot of musicians, I know you have, that they can really mail it in when they feel like it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They can play guitar once a week, and they're cool with that. You know, you and I are the types that play every day, constantly have ideas, constantly working on stuff. So I get what you're saying.
And truth be told, there's nothing wrong with that. And at the same time, before we had the Teen Jam days, which is going way back there, before there were kids in this area that had a way to, you know, show their musicianship and things like that and play live, it was difficult to try to get a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old to focus on a song instead of like being like, well, this is dumb, I want to go play outside or I want to go play video games.
That's true. You know? And that's the transition stage of aging part too, as well.
I think it may have been because I used drums as an outlet for anger whenever I was younger. Mm-hmm. I was very angry whenever I was very young. And
that's funny because I would have never, knowing you now, I wouldn't think you were an angry
kid.
No,
I mellowed out, but like 6 or 7 year old Ian, he was a nightmare. I guess it would have been before that. Man, I'm only 21 years old, but I have the brain of like a
60-year-old.
It's all going, man. But,
okay, so getting started, just jamming around, honing in your craft at a fairly early age, right? You started playing pretty young.
I did a lot of talent shows and things like that. I played drums and doing drum solos.
Right.
Where I would be adamant on trying to make not just like a steady groove through like an entire song, just like a backbeat or something like that, but I would try to piece together like a full song out of something that I could put together on drums. I am sorry, my coffee just went down the wrong chute.
Speaking of coffee, we're at Spencer's Coffee House.
We're at Spencer's Coffee House.
On beautiful College Street.
I'm going to drink this coffee into the microphone.
Mopi Delicious. Wasn't your first like band, was it?
It was not. Before Mopi, I had a couple other side projects and things like that. Bands like Pacific Outcast, which never played out. That was one of the main ones that, like, I was somebody who was like, hey, I can play drums, and some of the other guys needed to mature a little bit on their own, needed to kind of grow a bit on their own. And that's not to put anyone down. I'm saying that because I was, like, again, I was maybe 11 or 12 years old, and I was super adamant about, like, I want to play out. I want to do this.
Yep.
And, you know, it was tough to get people to...
You were a 22-year-old trapped in a 12-year-old body.
Before Mopi, the first serious band I had was a band called Le Garage.
I'm sorry?
Le Garage.
Le Garage.
Because there was a funny story behind that. I'm going to try to remember these details because they may kind of drift away from me. It has been forever since I've talked about Le Garage, but I started a band with... two brothers that I met at the Teen Jams, and we...
Now, the Teen Jam is part of the Kentucky Blues Society.
Yes.
But it was for kids, like under a certain age, I'm assuming, like under 18?
Yes. There is actually a funny
Kenny
story
Lee
behind that.
Would put that together, and this is at Wawa, correct?
Yes. Rest in peace. Never forget Wawa's. That was...
Pour some coffee out for
him. One of my dad's friends... John Lippert was a bass guitarist in the area.
Dr. John.
And I was friends with his son, Jacob. And Jacob played guitar, I played drums. And there was one night, that John called my dad and was like, hey, they're having like an open jam for kids if Ian would like to play at it. So they were nice enough to bring me out, and that was one of my first experiences like actually jamming in front of a crowd with other musicians and just, I guess, having a point of no return, which is, I don't know how to describe it, but there are situations where you play with people where you're like, oh, if we mess up, it doesn't matter. But like, you know, having that jam setting where you're like, oh, I want to get everything perfect whenever I play. And that was really good for me because that helped me to learn to play with other musicians. It helped me learn to grow myself as a multi-instrumentalist so I'd be able to write more music. And it was an overall great experience. They didn't end up continuing the teen jam because, unfortunately, there was like a lot of the people who originally went just eventually grew out of it, and we didn't get more younger kids coming to the jams, and so it eventually died out a few years back. But it was a great experience, and I honestly loved being a part of it.
It was obviously beneficial to you.
Definitely.
And of any of the kids that may have gone, obviously it definitely paid off for you to be there.
I met so many great musicians through it, and it opened so many doors. And
so, before we launch into the whole MoPi thing, which there may not be a grand amount to talk about there, but you guys did a significant amount of stuff in a very short time. The name was very popular around the Bowling Green music scene. I first heard the name long before I saw you guys.
Right.
But prior to that, obviously talking about Wah-Bah and the Teen Jam, you have been involved with the Kentucky Blues Society for quite some time.
I think part of it was once Le Garage broke up, I was nervous about playing live music again just because I was at the point where I was like, well, I'm still a drummer. It's going to be awkward if I come back to these jams, especially because the jam aspect of it was happening less and it was more of people doing solo sets or people doing band sets.
Right.
Which I think was another thing that may have been detrimental to it, but you know, that was something that nobody had control
it's
over.
It's just the roller coaster of how things go with music scenes.
But there was a period of time where I was nervous about playing again at the teen jams, and Kenny Lee, Ken Smith, if you remember the Ken Smith band and songs like My Big Fat Girlfriend.
Oh yeah.
Classic. And No Tell Motel.
I'm aware of it.
I have the old CD with his 80s mustache.
Is this with the Coors Light guitar?
Yeah. But that was one of those periods of time where I was, you know, I went through my first band breakup and I was very sad and I was very nervous about playing again. And he told me, oh, just come out to the blues jam and with the adult musicians. And I was anxious. And
it's like, because you graduated.
Yeah.
Musically, you graduate when you go from playing with a bunch of kids to 40-year veteran adult musicians, you know.
It felt like baptism by fire because I went from, you know, kids that would be super nervous about something messing up and sending like links to, I want to do this song, I want to do this song, let's get it right before we go there.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was in an aspect where I was in an environment where all the musicians were like, all right, everybody knows this, we're going to do this right now. Yeah. And I'm like, I have no clue what this song is. I don't know what any of this is.
That's
I still
the fun
remember
part about drums, though, is you can kind of fake your way through anything.
Well, kind of. And that's
a good
where
drummer
I
can do.
I think that's where I really grew as a jam drummer. Am I allowed to swear on this?
You can say whatever the fuck you want.
Neat. Well,
but your parents might hear it.
It's not even going to be that bad now. But no, that was
why do I ruin everything?
No, that's not true, man. You're the sole purpose of why the Bowling Green music scene is still
alive.
Well,
I cussed on your podcast, which we will get to later. But,
you did. That's fine.
Yeah.
You can everyone say does you want. Online.
This is not live radio. FCC ain't got shit on this. Go ahead with your story.
Greg Williams, that's where I grew at the adult blues jams because I was in that period of time where I was like, well, I can't mess up because these guys are already like, oh, I don't want to play music with a kid or anything.
Kid,
and I feel like that was I had to change how I played drums and change how I listened to other people because that's the biggest lesson that you can learn.
You have to up
as
your
a
game
drummer
pretty quick because you discover.
Man, you can do as many like neat tricks in your room playing drums as you want, but whenever you play out with a band, you have to be able to listen.
Oh yeah,
you know, and you have to be able to get from body language what somebody wants to do. And Greg, I've told Greg Williams a story, who is a member of Shady Jake and the Upsetters, who plays at the blues jams all the time. Greg Williams, one of the first times that I played at the adult jams, I got maybe one set in. I got very big for my britches. I was confident, and I was like, I know how to play drums. I know how to do this. And we were playing some song, and I start playing, and I played a little fast, and Greg slowed everything down, looked back at me, and went, slow the fuck down, slick. And I was like, oh. And I turned beet red, man. I was, like, so sad. I played that song, like, watching him like a hawk, trying to make sure that I played the exact tempo he wanted. But you know what? I needed that.
It made you a better drummer.
That was better for me than any of the, like, adult fake kindness, the kind of patronizing stuff to, oh, isn't this young person very good?
Yeah.
You don't want to scare off young people when they play music, but at the same time, man, you got to be honest with them. Because I wouldn't have grown without it.
That's a good point. And I think a lot of people nowadays, maybe, like you're saying, don't get the spankings they may deserve. They just get pampered with, oh, you're so good, you're so talented, and they're actually not that, you know, it's there, but they just kind of take the accolades and stop.
Right.
Because it's like, oh, obviously everybody's really impressed with me.
And it's just a weird middle ground to try to find because, you know, then you have the other end of it where you go too far and now they never want to come back and play music again.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, speaking of that and, you know, playing with guys that are older than you, more mature, have been playing for a long time and you're still a teenager, what course did that put you on? Being a young kid in modern day times, a lot of the music that I know of that you listen to and are influenced by, how did you discover that? Like, just by going to these jams? Like, did you just know at the age of 10 that blues and artists that were alive and recording between the 40s and 70s were what spoke to you? Like, how did you discover not only that music, but the fact that that was a big influence on you? How did you trip into that?
Truth be told, I didn't know blues before I started doing these jams.
Okay.
Like, I knew through classic rock. Like, to me, blues was Stevie Ray Vaughan and ZZ Top.
Right. I think a lot of people fall into that trap.
Which I don't think is a bad thing.
No. But the thing about music is when you discover an artist, that artist hopes you discover who influenced them.
There was a very good scene in a not really great movie that I always bring up every time I talk about it. I don't know if you've seen the movie La La Land.
No, I haven't.
It has fantastic music in it.
Is this with, like, Obi-Wan Kenobi?
No, it's not with Obi-Wan.
Oh, wait, I'm mistaken that for something else.
That's Moulin Rouge. That's a different one. One's
He does sing in that, doesn't he?
That one's not a great movie either, but that one's bad. But
there's Obi-Wan Kenobi.
There's a period in this movie where there's, to pretty much just set it up, there is Ryan Gosling's character is a very traditional jazz musician, and he joins a band with John Legend's character, who is like a jazz fusion would be the wrong word, but he does like a mixture between like jazz and hip hop and like techno kind of bass, like that kind of aspect. And they have a conversation where the traditionalist character says, like, oh, well, we can't do this, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is going to kill. Nobody's going to want to listen to the original traditional stuff. And then John Legend's character interjects and pretty much says, well, how do you expect anybody to go and listen to that? You know, you have to open the door in some way. You have to create a bridge for young people to want to listen to it. And I think that's the case with me and several other blues musicians.
I think that's the circle. Like, they always refer to things as the circle of life.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's the circle of music. You discover an artist that's around and active in your lifetime. And then they help point you back 20, 30, 40 years to when they were growing up, what they listened to and what influenced them to get to where they are. And then once that dam is opened, it's just complete flooding of music, overwhelming of discovering for a young mind to discover artists that recorded records 50 years before they were born and just changed their life. You know, when you listen, when I first heard, you know, Lead Belly was because of Nirvana. I'd never heard of Lead Belly, but when Nirvana did a song that you actually uploaded on the video,
I did.
I immediately went to the store, found a Lead Belly record, and listened to it and was like, holy God, this is amazing. And I'd never heard that man's name in my life.
And this is going to be a long transition. And if I start talking for too long,
well, you
got to
hurry up
stop.
Because we're on limited time.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I forgot. This is a podcast, and podcasts have time limits.
You got to hold them right where they need to be.
Well, for me at least, going back into the... I completely forgot where I was about to go with this.
That's okay.
But yes, opening the door for blues musicians, if it wasn't for the Eric Clapton, Stevie Ray Vaughan, ZZ Top, you know, guys like that, like even with... I love the Beatles. I have the Beatles permanently tattooed
on
my arm.
Yes, you are quite the Beatles fan.
I just showed that
tattoo
on the podcast, the audio podcast, of which nobody will be able to see.
It's a beautiful Beatles tattoo on his right, what,
my
muscle?
Right bicep. With yeah. Ringo is the closest to my heart because he's the most important.
Yeah, decent love.
Who doesn't like Ringo? He's just there to have fun. But... No, if it wasn't for those guys, you know, I never would have gotten into it, because that's what they did at the blues jams to, you know, help me get used to playing blues.
I agree, but if it wasn't for Eric Clapton and Cream, I would have probably never discovered Robert Johnson.
That's true.
And to me, that's where it all goes back to. And I know there were artists before him and things around the same time as him, but my God, when you listen to that, that's amazing.
I don't know how to say this without getting myself into trouble. A couple of points. First, I don't think something ever really truly kills a genre. I think genres of music evolve. That's why I roll my eyes into the back of my skull whenever I see something like Gene Simmons declares rock and roll is dead. Well, get out of here.
Yeah, it's always been stupid.
Gene's always been dumb, but...
Yeah, but there's been always
I'm
been
glad I can talk to
that.
You about this, because the last host would have killed
just,
me for it.
That's just a generation thing.
But, like,
things
genres
come
of music
and
evolve.
Come and go,
like,
you know?
Think about the White Stripes and the Black Keys and things like that, and Cage the Elephant. That's blues. That's blues influence.
I was
influence.
Hoping you were going with another color.
Oh, the Black Keys, the White Stripes, the... Oh, wow.
Is there a red
I can't,
band?
I'm going to hate myself so much. I'm going to think of one the second I walk out of
How
here.
How about the Yellow Jackets?
Yeah, the Yellow Jackets. Simply Red. that's not a real band.
There has to be something blue. Wow. I'm as lost as you are. Yeah. But you know what? That's what's beautiful about this. I think the coffee just kicked in, and so did a handful of drugs that I ate before we sat down and pushed the button.
Man, but I really love those old recordings. I'm sorry. You just made me think about it. Like, as much as I like those covers, I'm happy that I used them to be able to get to the old ones, because they're just... There's so many that those guys that I wouldn't have found otherwise. And there's an... Intimacy would be the wrong word, but there's an aspect to the old blues that... It's still alive in the music, but, like, you hear young people, and it's like they don't really know what the blues is like. You know, they don't know these guys that sang about the devil and, like, hard times and everything from sharecropping all day, right. You know? And that's why I like guys like Wolf. Mm. I don't know if there's ever going to be... A lot of people have tried to be Howlin' Wolf, but anytime I hear someone cover Howlin' Wolf, it's not
all
Wolf.
Those
there's
guys were completely
the,
original.
The
there's
best
no
way
to
possible,
even
man.
Try.
There's, I try very much in my stage persona, because I'm a very awkward and socially just uncomfortable person, and I have to mask that, and I mask
it's
that
by overcompensating. It's hard to look you in the eye while you're saying all this to me, because I'm like, do I need to look away?
I can look the other way when I say it, but yeah, that's why every time I'm on stage, I do the Howlin' Wolf. I'm like, oh, this song only goes out to the married women in the crowd, you know? Do that weird, like, shake thing where it's... Yeah. Howlin' Wolf was a 300-pound... I mean, he looked like a southern preacher. He was not a good-looking man. He sweat through every song he did, but still, everyone was like, that is the coolest guy in the room. Because he was, you know?
I would agree. Based there on was, the things I've seen and heard, I agree. And
even
you told
if
me
his,
pretty early on that he was a big influence
oh,
on
definitely.
You.
Oh,
so
definitely.
I know
even
you've
if he
done
was
a
like,
cover of Evil.
I have.
And you've suggested for me to try and do that at some point. I'm like,
so
I'm all
good.
For it, so... It
you know,
is a great
plus,
song.
You know, it's along with it. If you listen to those old recordings, they may not be like as tight as possible. There are beats missing that, like, the covers later fix. But I don't know. I like listening to the old, like, Lead Belly recordings and listening to the old Mississippi
it.
Fred McDowell.
It's
where it's
real,
like,
and it's raw, and it's something that doesn't really exist anymore. And very few can do it, and thankfully, some people do.
We're talking about music recorded before we were born in a coffee shop. We're
long
hipsters,
before.
Dude.
Oh, totally. I'm not really, but I guess I am today. So, blues jam turned you on to blues. And then you eventually, even still at a young age, ended up in a band called Mo'Pie. How did that get started?
Mo'Pie came about in a weird fashion. And that is a seamless transition, and there was no pause in there whatsoever, Dean.
Not at all.
I am very good at keeping the facade up. Yes, we did not pause for anything. Mo'Pie came about in a weird fashion. And that, like most musicians telling the story of how their band got together, this is going to be really long, and it's only going to matter.
Give me the Mo'Pie for Dummies version.
Mo'Pie for Dummies. So I'm doing these blues jams. At the same time, I start playing more. I feel more comfortable playing and doing multi-instrumentalist things at the teen jam. I've learned to belch away from the microphone. I'm a strange person, and there are many points where I remember the first time I heard somebody play music, and I remembered the first time I heard a friend of mine, Trey Farley, play music, because he was playing guitar, and he broke a string in the middle of a set, and he was like, hey, does somebody have a replacement? And Zach Smith, who used to run the jams, got him a guitar at the teen jam, and he broke another string, and then was like, I guess I'm done unless I can borrow another person's guitar. And I was like, I have a guitar. I'm going to see how this works. And Trey Farley was like, did Kurt Cobain, unless I'm wrong, did he at one point in his career have pink hair?
Yeah.
Okay, Trey Farley looked like that era Kurt Cobain.
Okay.
That's the only way that I know how to describe him. Because I come in, and there's this dude straight out of Seattle in the 1990s with his denim and like flannel and holes cut in his jeans, and you're not sure if it was on purpose or not. And
totally on purpose.
He was playing guitar, and I loaned him my guitar, and he played Norwegian Wood, and I was like, I love that song. Neat. He was a very interesting singer for me, because I heard him. He had a weird combination, again, going back to Kurt, a kind of mixture between like screaming and singing that he used on some songs. Not to say he screamed on everyone, but he had that aspect that I've never been super good at.
Hmm.
And I thought it was fascinating. And at one point we were jamming later on in the night, and he was playing bass. And I thought to myself, oh, this dude's just like a bassist, or sorry, bassist. This dude's just a guitarist who's playing bass for the jam. And we were like talking about a song that we were going to do, and it was Hotel California by the Eagles, which I didn't know at that period of time was his least favorite song ever in existence. And we go to start it out, and he was like, oh, what are we doing? And I was like, Hotel California. And I was like, oh, wait, hang on real quick. And I did the douchiest thing that I've ever done, because I didn't know him at this period of time. I just heard him play guitar. So I pointed out on the frets. I was like, oh, it's just here, 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 and then that loops, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, wow.
And he was like, okay. Probably getting annoyed with me because I hadn't seen him play bass before. And Trey Farley is a very talented bass guitarist. And so we went to start the song, and he didn't sabotage the song. He played the song great, but he made sure I knew he knew how to play the song. So he did way over the top, do 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 do, and like making faces at me the entire time he did, which I don't know if he remembers or if he knew that he did, but I remember hearing him do that, and I was like, note taken. And I was like, I want to be in a band with this dude. I remember afterwards we immediately hit it off, and we put together a band that was very short-lived called Thought for Not.
Okay.
Not spelled N-A-U-G-H-T, because we were edgy. We were like,
well,
young.
Well, somebody's got to do it.
We were young Anakin Skywalkers. I don't like sand, so we...
Good. He's stuck in some Attack of the Clones.
Though. Yeah, the best. I can't say that with straight.
No,
face.
Don't say the best.
It was definitely a movie. So we were doing Thought for Not stuff for a while, which included playing my school's talent show and doing Helter Skelter, and being asked not to play at the next talent show because I played the school's drum set and I may have kicked over the drums, threw the cymbals down, and screamed the "I got blisters on me fingers." Throw a drumstick into the crowd and all that shenanigans.
And what school was this?
It was South Warren High School.
Very good.
Which eventually let me play the senior talent show, was fine, which was nice. they were not fans of that. But Thought for Not
evolved into a Mo'Pie?
Well, Thought for Not, we had together for a while, and we didn't know that the Kentucky Blues Society sent groups for the International Blues Challenge, which is this huge festival down in Memphis. They get musicians from all over the globe that do all different styles of blues, and it may just be because I'm a blues musician. I've talked about it numerous times on my podcast, The Colonel Cast, and it is just like shameless plug.
The Colonel Cast
airs on Tuesdays and no, but it is like heaven. Like, I don't know how to explain it, but whenever you go down the street in the middle of the festival and there's music from every club pouring out, like, that's exactly what I, you know, live for.
Right.
That eventually grew into Mopi, as we were one night asked to come out to the blues jams, where I met Aaron Holder, who was a musician who had gone a couple of years before.
That was a door.
Thanks.
Live studio audience. I wasn't kidding.
Live studio audience. He could have just like gently, but he was like, "No, there's a microphone light right there. I'm gonna drop kick this."
He knew what he was doing.
This door shut like I'm Randy Orton. So yes,
I got that. It took a minute, but I got it.
I got to meet Aaron Holder, who is a very talented guitarist who went from one of the bands the year prior, and together we were just Aaron Train Ian. We went one year to the International Blues Challenge to play a set, and it was very fun. It was a grand old time. The next year we went to go, and we added a member in Ian Loveless, who I don't know if he still goes by it at this point, but to me he will forever be Deebs, because we called him that in the band, and I completely forgot why. So Deebs, who is a very talented harmonica player, and we were
still
like,
is.
Well, we're not going to be Aaron, Trey, Ian, and Ian. You know, we have to come up with a name at this point.
True.
And Kenny Lee, ever the marketing expert, salt of the earth, love Kenny Lee. Kenny Lee is my favorite meme. Kenny was trying to think of creative ways to bring bigger crowds out to the blues jams. So his way of going about this was obviously through pastries. He started bringing desserts to the blues jams, and that would be his advertising point. He would be like, "Come out to the blues jams, we'll have cake and pie.
Have a tasty treat."
But Kenny talks in a funny way that was like, it's similar to Kenny Lee speaks.
I really hope like he's from Louisiana.
Yes,
or something.
He's like, if you listened to Billy Gibbons try to do an impersonation of Billy Gibbons, it would sound like Kenny Lee.
Interesting.
Yes, because he comes out and he loves whenever I do impressions of him, because they're all bad. But he's like, "Oh, yeah, you know, we see." He also has a way of saying a lot of words to me, and I maybe understand three or four of them.
Oh, man.
It's good. It's like the dude from The Waterboy with the super Cajun accent. "Hey, yo, you know, dig gator."
Well,
that's
to me, when I first met him, I was like, this guy's Cajun.
He's,
because he sounded Cajun.
He does very much. But, man,
he just... I apologize, Kenny, if you're from, like, you know, Nebraska or something.
Kenny's way of bringing people out was bringing these pastries, and he would like stop in between sets and he'd be like, "Hey, I just want to let everybody out there know we got cake and we got pie, and if you like cake and you like pie, we got mo cake and we got mo pie." And he got so over the top the more it went on. He would drag
fantastic.
It on. Thank
no,
you.
No, please stop. That was superb.
Dean, he would do the, like, I can't remember the dude's name, but the dude who would do the boxing announcements or the, "Hey, let's get ready to rumble."
I don't know his name either.
I can't remember his name. I'm gonna remember it again as soon as I leave. But Kenny would do that with the cake and pie, where eventually it got to the point where it was so ridiculous. It would be like, "We got mo cake and we got mo pie." And he would just go ecstatic with it. I'm glad that everybody in Spencer's Coffee is looking at me for it.
I
swear this person actually exists, and he's one of my favorite people to listen to play music. So Kenny Lee would do this, and it got so ridiculous that I was like, we are all here in some form or another because Kenny, you know, from arranging the jams to getting us together to play music and give us these opportunities.
Right.
Let's do an homage to him. And we decided to use Mopi as a result. I think that was my dad recommended that to us. He was like, why don't you guys call yourselves Mopi? And we were all like, well, we love Kenny.
And it worked.
And so,
it's
yeah.
a great name.
And it's catchy and it's bluesy.
Like, when I heard it, I was like, well, that sounds like a cool band. And I think that's pretty common with anybody. When you hear a cool name,
yeah.
you just instantly think it's going to be a good band. So I was shocked the first time I saw you guys. Was kind of strange because I was asked to be a judge in a battle of the bands at the Spillway Bar yes. and Grill. And Robert Baxter contacted me and said, would you do this? And I said, sure, absolutely. And back in my day, I won a few Battle of the Bands, or at least the bands I was in did. So I was like, yeah, absolutely. I'd love to be a part of that. And you guys were on the bill, and it was a very eclectic mix of bands. It was like 10 bands.
That is the best way to describe it.
Well, it was diverse.
Yes,
I mean, it
very
had
much
country
so.
And heavy metal and you guys, which I would put into a blues category or blues rock category. But anyway, myself and the other three judges, when you all hit the stage, I mean, you're 30 seconds into the first song, which was Mississippi Queen, by the way.
Yes,
I still remember
it
to this day. You kicked off the cowbell, the band starts, and as soon as the lights came up and your full band launching into that riff, we all kind of looked at each other and was like, well, there's the winner. And you guys were like the third band of the night. Like, we still had, you know, 6-7 bands to go at that point. And I just remember looking down the table and going, well, there they are. You just write the check now. And sure enough, you all won. Now, that wasn't based on just me. It was all four judges filling out a sheet of level 1 to 10 of all these different categories. So you clearly won. Second place, by the way, was the band No Deceit.
No Deceit.
They're extremely, really good.
Yes.
And but I guess they lost by like maybe a point. So
I,
it wasn't the
I
fact that you all
an
were
angry
kids.
Facebook
it had nothing
about
to do
that.
With the fact that you all were kids, which you were. You were still right. very much in high school and teenagers. But we were blown away at the musicianship. And I remember at one point, because every band got like 20 minutes. So you all did like 4 or 5 songs. And one of the other judges was Jason Simpson, who is now the bass player for Coulter Wall.
Right.
So obviously this guy has a knack for understanding music and talent.
Right.
And he looked at me and was like, these guys are clearly jazz trained professionals, because he could tell like certain cues and a certain way that people would nod and eye contact at each other. We could read the stage presence between the band of how you all would look at each other and nod at each other and do all of the, you know, cues that musicians pick up on, but maybe an audience member wouldn't.
Yeah.
And so that was our first impression. And as soon as you all were done, you were underage, so you had to go outside.
Which was fun.
And I sat through the rest of the show, and it was good, and it was fun. But as soon as the last band was done, I filled out the scorecard, I turned it in, and I immediately went outside to find you guys, and I found you. So
yes.
This was my introduction to you. I introduced myself, and I said, that was fantastic. I was really, really impressed, especially with you as a drummer. And we talked for a good minute, and I said something along the lines of, if you guys don't win, don't let it get you down. You're good. Keep doing what you're doing. And
yeah.
Sure enough, you won. So I would think that pretty early on, as the band got going, that was a great launching piece, I would think, to have under your belt as a young kid and have a future ahead of you, and you personally having a strong passion for music. What did I know the band eventually fell apart,
right?
How long did it last, though? Like 2 years, give or take?
It lasted, the band altogether, we are so seamless
we are so
at our
in the way,
transitions.
But we needed the power outlet.
We did. That's okay.
She doesn't seem to mind.
No, this is. We're all just adding to the show for the crowd.
It is.
Yep. For the sound atlas. This is what they listen
There's
for.
There's a door behind Ian that apparently Ian is blocking, and I moved the table to where the table shouldn't be because I needed a power outlet.
It's fine. The band altogether, I believe, lasted. I I'm old, and so my brain doesn't work.
Yeah, you're
anymore.
Old.
I'm very
yeah,
old at
thank
21
you
years
for that.
Old. You're welcome.
I'll smack you after we're done.
Dean, are you like twice my age?
I'm 20 years older than you. You're 21, right?
Yes.
I'm 42. Yeah.
There you go.
So shut up with your old age crap, you stupid kid.
I only
and
do
get
that
on
to
with
drive
the
me
band
nuts.
Story.
No, I think Mopai was together for about 6 or 7 years.
Really?
But that version of MoPie, because we changed members like every couple of years, and I was the only constant in it from the original lineup.
So I saw you fairly late.
Yeah, so I guess I would have, my memory could be wrong, but I believe it was like 6 or 7 years that we were the group that would go down and do the IBC.
Okay.
But it wasn't until, I want to say, maybe like 6 months to a year before that event, that we were like, let's get serious about this, even though we're from all over the place and it'll be a hassle to do rehearsals. Let's actually start doing gigs on a regular basis.
Right.
And so that was at the point where we got very serious, and that was probably the height of us as a band, because we all pushed ourselves individually, like, to be the best musicians we could be, and to do the best that we could do to bring everything together. And that's where a lot of the signals and everything came from. We would regularly play at blues jams and everything like that, and I know it happened with me and a couple of the other musicians, but specifically me and the lead guitarist, I treated the drums, I don't want to say as an instrument, because obviously it's an instrument, but I treated it almost the way that somebody treated a pitched instrument, and the way that if you listen to like the Allman Brothers, how everything builds off of each other, I knew that.
Right.
I knew the kind of well that he would go to whenever he would do solos, and I would try to tell myself, well, what can I do to add to this?
Right.
So if I knew he was about to go into triplets, you know, a triplet groove over a solo, well, I'm going to start doing triplet grooves quick, and I'm in the front of the door again. I'm sorry about that. But yes, I would pretty much just do everything that I could to build off of how he played. And that eventually grew to everybody doing it. You know, everybody tried to not necessarily be the look at me area of musicianship, but if we're going to put something out, what can we do to make the overall sound the best that we can live?
Right. I understand.
Yeah.
I speak that language. Well, the band was really good. That was my first time seeing you, was at that Spillway Bar and Grill Battle of the Bands, which was 2015,
that
I believe.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, because Jason and I were in a band at the time.
Yeah.
And it was odd that he showed up, and I was like, oh, I didn't know I was going to be a judge on this panel with my bandmate. And for the record, the other judges, I don't know if you know this, it was Jim Madison and Connie. Jim and Connie from Print Mafia.
I did not know that.
That's who the other judges were. Hmm. So we all four agreed that MoPie was the best band of the night. And therefore, you got the big giant check.
Oh, that was fun. I still have that giant check, by the way.
I remember I was there when the check
couldn't
was
find a giant
I took
teller.
A picture of you guys getting the check. And then, like, was it your dad that had the handled the money that night? I remember he handed each of you like $200 a piece. It was so cool to watch that, because I remember being your all's age, being like, "Oh my God, we won!"
Yeah,
and being handed cash.
We were
for
very
playing
much like
drums
that.
For 20 minutes.
We were. I mean, we kind of assumed like, "Oh, we're probably going to end up either like being one of the top bands with it," but we didn't expect to win. So we did very much have that. What?
It was good.
You know, and we were then. I was like starting to walk out whenever they were getting ready to announce the winner, because they did third place and second place, and then I was like, oh, well, damn it, we didn't even make the... And then they said us, and I was...
Now, 10 bands, we didn't even make the top 10.
It was good.
Well, I saw you guys there. That was my first introduction, and then I would hear the name, and you played, I believe, at 440, or...
Yeah.
What was Cliffs of Dover at the time?
Cliffs of... Patent Pending?
Yeah, no. Patent Pending. Yeah. You played out in front of that.
Yes.
And I believe you played out in front of 440 one time, and I think I saw you at a concert in the park. Is that right?
Yes. We did a concert in the park. Concert in the park I won't get into.
Well, all those...
We were asked to open for a band, and we accidentally
for.
Overshadowed them.
I saw you at all these things because, obviously, you were underage, so you weren't booking shows at the bars and stuff. So that was really the only way I could see you guys live, was to play at one of these outdoor type things, and it was great, and that's how we met and we became friends, and I'm thankful for that. So going from the MoPie fizzling out, where did you go? What kept you going? What was your driving force after that? Because I know what that's like.
And
I'm just curious, what was your motivation to keep going, and what did you... I know that
obviously you kept attending the blues jams, mm-hmm. and that's obviously a really good thing for any musician in this area. It's every Sunday.
I think it's just, I didn't necessarily start doing any sort of band or projects or anything like that, but I won't lie, I was very sad for a period of time. Without sounding disrespectful to anybody who's gone through it, the best way that I could describe the band breakup, and many musicians will describe their breakups this way, is it felt like a divorce.
It does.
By the time we got done, and I won't personally trash anybody, I won't talk about anything like that, but we were just, everybody was tired. Nobody liked talking to each other. You know, there were members of the band that were fired that the entire band didn't agree on. Mm-hmm. There were managers that were fired without the entire band agreeing upon it. There were songs that were deemed not good enough anymore that we wanted to, there were members that wanted to like do like this direction and go into this kind of sound, and members that wanted to go into this kind of sound. And I think we got to the point where we got a little, in our own way, egos were the downfall for everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody, you know, was like, oh, I want to do my side projects over here. I want to do my side projects over here. And everybody was, I think it may have just been, we weren't happy with it anymore. And I had to, after the firing of our manager before me, I had to step in and become the manager for, I want to say it was close to a little over a year, I think. I think that's right. It may have been less than that, but I think it was about that long. And there was only so much of, you know, trying to remind people, hey, I need you to show up here. I need you to be right here, you know, and having them not do it on their own. And there's only so many times you can be told, like,
that's true.
You know, you're like, hey, we're only going to make this much. And they're like, hey, kill yourself. And you're like, I can't. Yep, I heard that a lot. And you're like, I don't know. I think at the same point, they would probably have a lot of not happy things to say about me. I really liked Aaron Tagliabashi. He was a keyboard player. Never had a problem with him. He was good. He was the level-headed
one in
the group.
Failure is the best tool to learn from
for
a lot of
things. Like,
but you did pick yourself up kept going. And as a multi-instrumentalist, you have obviously done several things on your own.
Well,
drumming-wise, you're active. Obviously, blues jam, but you've played on some recordings with me.
Yes.
And then you've recorded some of your own stuff where you've played all the instruments, which is always cool. Not many people can do that. So I know a lot of people that can play a lot of instruments, but they can't play drums. And they'll have to use a drum machine or hire someone to do the actual drum track in order for them to lay down all the bass, guitar, keyboards, vocals. And a lot of people can do that, but not many people can actually play drums well enough to record an entire piece or an entire album. And you are one of the rare people that can do that. So I know you kept going with that. So where are you now as things have deteriorated from that band over time? I mean, it's been a slow process, but it's been a few years now.
Well, I decided, I was down in the dumps. There was a month where we're going to take a break as a group and things of that nature. And I went to do a radio appearance where I was going to talk about it. And I found out a very short period of time, I think it was like a day maybe, where I just got a press release from one of the members of the band, hired a press agent, which is silly to say because they weren't doing gigs, but hired a press agent to do a release that was like, these are the reasons why I'm leaving the group and things like that, and which was embarrassing for me because now I'm like, oh, well, now I have to go and say, well, this was all not true. But through that kind of toxic environment and relationship, I was very sad, but I learned that it wasn't necessarily a bad thing. And it, just like going through a divorce, a lot of people will be like, I'm sorry that you went through that. But there is, in one good thing in it, you find freedom. And I was like, well, I, for so long, had to worry about, well, what can I write that this person it will match this person's style, you know? Because I have to write this guitar lick in the way that I know this person is going to play it, you know, or something similar to it. Or what genre can I bring to the table? Because we had done, like, a lot of blues, country, R&B, things of that nature. But I wanted to experiment with other genres of music, just as they did. And
there's nothing wrong with that, especially when you're young. It's part of the growing pains of honing a craft, you know?
Right. And I wanted to try, you know, playing other instruments out more. I wanted to try different, you know, I talked about the different genres. I wanted to try recording music. It was fascinating to me because I had no experience with it apart from we did some small recordings that we didn't end up releasing, probably never going to be, hopefully.
That sucks.
But I sat and watched a sound engineer work, but I never really had hands-on experience. And that was where I ended up coming to you with the song that I originally wrote and was going to give to Mopai, because they kind of made me the de facto songwriter for the group. Just because, again, I'm trying my hardest to be positive through this, but there were many experiences
where, man,
I was like, you know, I need some of you guys to start pulling your own weight, bringing some more songs forward. And there were members of the group that were releasing things on their own and not bringing their music forward, or just not writing music. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be mean, but I never really thought that writing music was that difficult, especially in a band environment. If you have something that's, you know, just minor, and, you know, something small that's put together, if you bring that to a group of musicians, we can work together and turn it into something. Yeah. You know, if you have enough talking heads in the room, it's going to become something big. But it'll become something.
It'll be big in your head.
I spent many a nights in this coffee house trying to write songs for that purpose. And as a result, I was like, well, I had this song called Iron City that I originally wrote as a blues song. And I wanted to bring it to the guys, but at the same time, I was like, well, they're not going to say yes to it. Because at that point, they were trying to change their sound. They were trying to distance themselves from the blues scene.
They go techno.
Well, not necessarily, but closer than you would assume. Yeah, kind of. There was definitely a technological...
Are you serious? Because
they
want
to do very experimental things with it. I say experimental. They wanted to do things that... Yeah, I guess that would be the best way to say it. And again, I wanted to go in different directions as well. I wanted to try things that they weren't necessarily...
You're more organic.
Yeah, I wanted to do jazzier and R&B kind of stuff, but I had this blues song, and I knew that they weren't going
to... And you bring it to me.
I did, because I just kept it to myself, because I was like, the band's not going to do anything with this.
Yep.
So I afterwards messaged Captain Dean, and I was like, well, hey, Dean, if you wouldn't mind, I would like to record this song with you, because I know your style with the kind of garage rock, and even though you're not a stoner anymore, the stoner rock.
Yeah, I still never understood why people compared what I did to stoner rock.
We're just going
to
call it Dean.
It was
the
in
genre
drop D,
music.
And it sounded heavy and slow moments of
did
slow.
Did you ever think of putting a band together called Drop Dean?
No.
Oh.
But I
keep that
now.
One in the back pocket.
I'll hang on to that.
But yeah, I was like, I want to try this with you. And it was first kind of awkward because we were like, hey, we've only talked in passing.
True, but I mean, weird, I was open to the idea because I was in the boat similar to yours where my band had kind of dissolved and I was working on a record on my own.
Right.
And sometimes you can only get so much accomplished, or sometimes I think working alone gets extraordinarily boring.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have another person in the room to bounce ideas off of, and you brought the song. It was the music was there, the lyrics were there. You just came to me to help record it and find a happy medium, and you thought that I could help you bring that song to light, and together we did, and I think it turned out really good. So check out the song Iron City.
Iron City.
Which is... So far, the first collaboration we've done.
Yes.
But I think there are more in the future.
I think there are, too.
And speaking of the future.
Yeah.
And the present.
And the present.
Where are you today with your music and music in general?
Well, currently I'm sitting in Spencer's Coffee Shop. You wanted me as a guest. You knew what you were getting into.
I sure did.
To be honest with you, Dean, I'm...
You post a lot of videos.
I do.
And you have a thing on your Facebook page or Instagram that you call Big from the Big Comfy Chair.
Live from this comfy chair.
So you'll play guitar, or today you uploaded a video of you playing banjo.
Yes.
And you do various songs. And so obviously you're happy and you're still playing music on your own terms. And you're having a good time with it.
Yes.
You know, you're recording. I know you've done some recordings that haven't been released yet. And then you upload videos every now and then. So where are you? Like, where are you at in music for you at this time?
I think I'm still in that, you know, not getting over the divorce phase, but that you know, freedom phase of, well, why don't I just do this? Why don't I just record this? You know, I for so long thought of recording as something scary, and then I was like, well, I could do this on my computer.
Yeah.
And I did it on my computer. And, you know, whenever
you did
there
the
were,
hell out of it.
There was someone who asked me to be in their folk bluegrass band just to do a small set somewhere. And instead of being like, well, I don't want to do a one set band thing and not play again, I was like, I'm not experienced with that genre. I want to do it, you know? And I've learned to stop saying no to things in music that I was scared of, despite the fact that Ronald Reagan would try to tell me to just say no. Ronald Reagan, what was his stupid wife's name? Nancy, there you go.
Is that stupid? Show some respect.
Didn't you know that that...
She's dead.
Didn't you know that that solved the drug problem, was saying no once?
Yes. I think the better campaign from that era, which is long before you were probably born, was the frying egg in the pan.
This is your brain.
This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions? Like, yeah, I have a question. Isn't that an egg? Is that breakfast?
I'm like 90% sure the person who wrote the skit was on drugs. That one and the, I don't know if you're, this was from my childhood, the sketches of the dude and his dog, and the dog would talk to him and say like, hey man, I don't like the choices you're making.
It's just
and he's
from
like you're
the
a
90s?
Dog. No, this is from the like mid-2000s. I
the
remember watching it on TV being like, I don't know what drugs are, and even I know this is silly. But yeah. No,
well,
that's
let me ask you this. So musically, in Ian's world right now, you're happy.
I am happy.
And you're finding happiness, not only as a solo artist.
Also doing group stuff.
You are jamming stuff on the side. We got something.
Yeah. Do we talk about it?
We can talk about it.
Is that a conflict of interest on this podcast?
I think from the airing of this podcast, it's probably still a few months away from being like publicly released, but yeah, we're jamming.
You know, we can just drop a band name right here, and Seth wouldn't be here to be able to say
Big
that's
Riff
not the,
is not here to back this up. But
yeah, we are Big Riff and the Big Kahunas.
That's right. I'm not even going to get into the actual name because it's got a story of its own.
Oh, it does. You know, man, I just like being able to just being the hippie that I am. I like just like living the free life, you know. I like just doing stuff with music. When I write something and I'm like, this is dumb or this is silly, I'm like, you know what?
But you know
I'm
going
to record it and see what happened. Dean, I recorded an EP that was entirely wrestling songs.
And speaking of that, I know about this EP.
Yes.
I haven't heard it, but I know about it. But you and I have a solid mutual love for a band based out of Nashville.
Yes.
It's John Tidball's brother.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know
the
that.
The lead vocalist is... That's John's brother.
Fascinating.
It's Charles, right?
Yes.
Charles Tidball. Anyway, he's in a band called the Mighty Jabronis.
They're great.
And we... Ian played drums for me at one Captain Dean show. And we played at Tidball's, and we opened for the Mighty Jabronis. And I explained to you that this band is fully based on like wrestling. They love wrestling of all types and genres. And you lit up like a Christmas tree. You were like, are you serious?
I love professional wrestling.
And so I started explaining to him, like, oh, they put on the bit, they wear the outfits, they put on a show, and they, you know, jump off the stage and headbutt you and all this stuff. And Ian was just like, oh my God, when is this show? I'll be there. So that was why he played drums for that show. He didn't care about the songs.
Oh, no, I didn't.
But that was really cool. And I to me, the comedy aspect of some of the songs you write, they lyrically or comic-wise, it's no different than that. Like, there can be a theme. There can be an entertainment factor that ties into music, and it can work or it can fail. And those guys make it work, and I think a lot of like influences that you have made it work. What are your biggest influences?
Funny you say that. Musically, my biggest influences will always be the Beatles, and I don't want to just name 1,000 bands. Beatles will always be
the number
one. What
are your biggest influences? What made the biggest impact of you? Yeah, Howlin' Wolf, the Beatles.
As far as songwriting goes in that aspect, my two biggest influences were Jim Croce, who I think is one of the best lyricists ever. I love all of his music. And on top of that, I don't know if it's obvious in some of the songs that I play, but the Bare Naked Ladies.
It is to me.
Yes.
And I got it. And I think a lot of people would, if they heard more of your stuff, I think they would pick up on that.
I think it's okay to like still be serious musicians and still try to put out a product that, you know, you want somebody to listen to and think, wow, that's awesome. But
you can open that door all you want because, you know, we're just guests.
Sorry. You're good. We'll just let you know that the next time it happens, we'll have you join the episode. Yeah. I hope this all stays in.
Of course it will. I'm not touching this.
The Bare Naked Ladies, I wish were from just a stone's throw away from Lockport,
New
York.
Probably pretty high up on your level of Canadian-ish.
In the tropical, that's my New York coming out, in the tropical land of Kenyatta.
Kenyatta.
Yes. It is like Canada.
I have been through Buffalo once.
It's sad.
We were passing through.
It's gray.
We drove through Buffalo. We drove through Niagara Falls.
We eat chicken wings to have something spicy and alive
the Bills
in our lives.
Still suck.
The Bills lose all the time. The Sabres were doing great. They were on a 9-game win streak, and then they lost to the Predators. That was sad.
But the Predators are awesome.
They're good. The Predators are fun because every time I like a player from the Sabres, they'll leave the Sabres because they get too good for the Sabres money. And they'll end up in Nashville, and I'm like, I can drive to see them play now.
Is there anything about the Bowling Green music scene that means something to you? Is there anything about it that influences you? Are there any bands here or anything outside of what you're involved in that has any substance for you?
Well, I definitely think, and everybody's going to say this whenever they play, but along with the blues aspect and things that I talked about earlier, I feel like my generation in particular, I feel like I've always had good, I don't know what the word would be for it, because it's not competition in music, but I definitely have peers that are close to my age that push myself as a musician, push myself in my lyricism, that every time I hear them, I know I want to be able to write more like that person. I want to be able to play more like that person. I know that I've had people tell me the same thing in regards to me. There are musicians that we've talked about, we've hyped up so much, like Kenzie Crowe.
Oh, yeah.
And the Flaming Hots. They are phenomenal. I love them. And Palmer St. Clair. I'm going to hate myself.
It's what's cool
about
the
Josephines.
Them.
There you go. Love the Josephines. Oh, they're going to be mad at me for that.
No, they're not.
No, they're very laid back. But I just love this scene because I go out and I listen to some of these groups, and even the ones that are like just up and coming, there's a passion that I feel for the music here. It's not all
it's the same alive.
The same white teenager that's like, anyways, here's Wonderwall for the 1,000th time, or here is my favorite one because I had to play this. Stuck Like Glue. You and me, baby, were stuck like glue. Have you heard that song?
Dude,
it's literally the worst.
I
hate it.
I'll
slap
chair.
Myself if I do it again. I hate that song.
Slap you with your own hand.
I will do the same
sugar.
Thing
no
I'm
going
to do to the Mighty Jabronis if they try to outsell my album.
Like you did not,
I'm going to put them in small packages.
I'm going to pretend like you didn't bring up Sugarland.
That's a wrestling
one
move
of the
when
worst
you
songs
tuck someone's
ever
head. You go to pin them.
History of music.
And then you just leave them there like a pretzel.
Like, that song's in my top 10 most hated songs of all time.
I hate it so much.
I hate you now.
I hate me.
I hate you
regularly. I don't know if you can tell my music. I'm very sad.
No, I can't, actually. Your music's very good to me. I've always thought it was very upbeat.
Yeah,
and
I try.
Obviously, it's you. Like, your personality comes through in your music really well. And I think you
capture
that. Which
is both a good and a bad thing. It's sometimes difficult when I try to write songs for other people to play, and they're like, this sounds like a Bare Naked Ladies song. This sounds wacky. And I'm like, well.
Well, then you write songs about, you know,
Ian, this
weird
is
things.
A song that I wrote here. They're like, Ian, this song contains the line, I'm the realest. What does that mean?
That means you're pretty real.
Yeah. doesn't it? I don't know.
I speak.
I don't
your
know.
Language.
I'm wacky. I'm like. That's why I love the Bare Naked Ladies. And like, I just made you say underwear. Like,
yeah, I always thought that was funny. Which I'm not as familiar with them as you are, but what I've heard is funny.
Yeah,
I remember prior to them, there was the Crash Test Dummies,
right?
Which they kind of fell in that same category of odd, strange, but also funny, but also well done. So it's cool that things can do that. But Ian,
yes.
Before we go, you are Colonel Ian.
I am Colonel Ian.
Are you a real colonel?
Boy, am I.
Now, how can you be a Kentucky colonel from New York? Because I find that utter bullshit. I am not a real captain, but I play one on TV. And I can't be a Kentucky colonel because I'm a captain.
Dean, are you aware that if for some reason the United States was ever invaded and we needed to call upon the Kentucky militia, I hold an actual position in the Kentucky militia.
I hope you have a musket.
Oh, boy, do I. I have a Nerf gun, and I have the sharpest tool.
You better have a lightsaber.
Yeah, I have the Darth Maul one. And, like, not the light-up one. I mean, like, the plastic one that hurt when you smacked someone with it.
Yeah, the plastic ones are a lot harder.
We played lightsabers. Like, we played with the lightsabers when we were kids, and we would just come home with, like, welts all over.
Yeah, I didn't do that.
No, we were idiots. I grew up in a generation that played with actual lawn darts, too.
Yeah, you did. That's why they're outlawed. But thanks to you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And I think
also
the
I want to add
scene is really good with people like you in it because
you
are diverse. You support multiple different bands and venues, but you're also very much a part of it. So.
Well, yeah.
As a fan of yours and as a friend of yours, I appreciate what you do as a contribution to this music scene.
Well, of course. And as you know, for what you do, I mean, if you take it too much as the competitive angle and things like that, like I did whenever I was a teenager, you know, you stop growing with the music scene. You start worrying about, well, what can I do that person can't, blah, 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 blah. If you don't build up the people around you, then, you know, you're not going to have the same drive. You're not going to have the same passion, you know?
That's true. It's a very good point.
I've always felt that. By the way, Whoopi Goldberg is also Kentucky Colonel and is not from Kentucky. Same thing with George W. Bush.
So it's like buying a Hollywood
It's not a real
star,
thing.
A Walk of Fame star.
It's not a real thing.
It's a piece of paper.
It is. It's a piece of paper hanging up in my mom and dad's house because they're very proud of me.
And your parents should be very proud of you. I've met your parents. They're extremely nice.
They are. They had two children, and I wasn't that much of a screw-up. My sister is an actual, like, human being that's functioning in society, but I'm almost there.
You're getting there.
Yeah, I'm on my way.
Some things age better with time.
I'm like the Phil Collins song from Brother Bear, "Tell Everybody I'm On My Way."
You really throw some curveballs.
Boy, do
I. Yes, you do. Somebody will get that.
Do you remember when Phil Collins was in, like, every children's movie?
I did, but, dude, I was, like, in my 20s and doing adult
You weren't watching Brother Bear?
When all that came out. No, I did not. I did watch a lot of Ren and Stimpy, and I don't remember it.
I act like, but I never grew out of watching children's movies. That's why I watched.
I watch them now.
Yeah.
Because my daughter's really into the.
I get mad
Pixar
at myself
stuff.
That I can't write the flamenco kind of style, the Latin guitar style from like movies like Coco. I listened to that movie and I genuinely
I haven't
was
seen that
like,
movie yet. Don't ruin it for me.
I won't. Just music is fantastic in it.
Well, yeah, I've heard that. I'm really bad about movies. I'm not a movie.
That's
fan.
Okay. I am too. I only
I
watch
Star Wars.
Dude, I only watch. Bad movies that I shouldn't go see. Like, I went and saw Delivery Man in the theaters with Vince Vaughn. Do you remember that movie?
No.
I don't either.
I like Vince Vaughn.
I saw the remake of The Great Gatsby but missed every movie that I wanted to see. That one was bad.
Yeah,
I demanded my money back afterwards and got my money back for it.
Really?
Yes, because it was that terrible.
Well, that's talent.
I felt nauseous watching it.
Well, I feel nauseous now, and we need to go.
We do need to go.
I've had too much coffee.
It's too much coffee.
Colonel,
it's like one tall coffee.
Colonel Ian Harper, thank you for being here today on the
Captain
Sound
Ian.
Atlas, and I am just thrilled to death to have sat down and talked with you. And one more thing before we go. What does music mean to you?
music is literally my entire livelihood.
Entirely.
I almost got through the entire podcast without botching words. But
well,
that's
fine.
I'm
glad you finally did, because it wouldn't be a Colonel Ian moment without some botching.
Music is how I express myself if I want to sound like the characters from High School Musical. Now you made me realize it, so now I can't do it. But no, that was, you know, when I got the drum set as a kid. I beat the hell out of the drums whenever I got mad. Whenever I get sad, I go and write blues music. You know, there whenever you I'm overjoyed with happiness, I sit down at the piano and I try to
blues.
Write what I think is ragtime,
happy
which
blues.
Ends up
oh,
happy
ragtime.
Blues.
There you
yeah.
go. Yeah.
It's not good. It's not good, because ragtime is way more difficult than I expected it to be.
Well, you are a good friend to me, and I know that there's a lot of people in this music scene that have a lot of respect for you as a musician and just as a songwriter.
Maybe not the Mighty Jabronis, though, because they know I'm coming to steal their gimmick.
I hope you get some top rope action.
Oh, I
this.
Do. If they try to fight me on it, I'm going to put them all in small packages. That's where you grab someone, you like get their head, and you like roll them up on the side, and you roll them into a pinning thing, and then you get up, and they're still stuck there like a pretzel, and you just leave them there.
And there is the wrestling.
I'm
going to
put them in a small package.
I've been waiting for
maybe do a sunset flip.
Interview.
That's where you leap over someone, and then you roll them up and pin them. Or maybe an arm drag. You wanted to have me on the show, man.
Yeah, but I knew there were some references wrestling.
I didn't even get to...
It's hard to say wrestling references, but I just did.
At least it's better than the Colonel Cast, where I just throw out random stuff halfway through interviews like, hey, Captain Dean, what are your thoughts on Space Jam, the movie where Michael Jordan teamed up with the Looney Tunes and Bill Murray to take on the Monstars with Danny DeVito?
No comment.
That's the best answer to it.